In today's episode, join us for an end of year wrap up. We talk about everything that has been the year of 2020, plus we answer your questions.
Hey guys, just a warning, this episode discusses the year that was 2020 and has been generally a trigger for everyone. If this is a major trigger for you, we strongly suggest you skip the episode.
Hello everybody, welcome back to a very special episode. I am Kat, I am one of your hosts and I am a registered psychologist.
And I'm Amy, a registered psychotherapist.
It is a very special episode, very sad episode, but also very exciting episode. How are you, my sweet darling, Amy Hudson?
I am good. It is our last episode for 2020, and what a whirlwind year it has been for us. It's been a huge year for both of us, and I think I am just really, really ready for a break, if I'm being completely honest. It is the last year of work for us. Last year, see
the retirement.
Hello, retirement. No, it is the last week before we both go on a well-deserved break, I would say. So I'm feeling just ready for some rest and chill time. What about you, Katniss? How have you been?
I've been good. I feel like it's been ages since we've recorded our little potty together. Yes, I feel exactly the same, Ames. It's just been, I was saying to you off mic, like I think definitely mental health has taken such a big hit this year. So those that work in the industry have just been so worn out. And I think any health industry as well, not just mental health. I think it's just been, you know, kind of a big year for all of us, you know, on the front line or just the mental health workers or in health. So I think everyone deserves a 6 month trip somewhere at the end of this year.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Katniss, what has been your 2020 pit and peak?
Such a big one. So I think my 2020 pit and peak has, I don't know, it's hard to kind of encapsulate a whole year into a pit or a peak, but I think that my pit would be that considering the year, like I think when I was reflecting on the year, we had the bushfires, we had the obviously COVID-19, we had a lot of social stuff like the Black Lives Matter movement. I think a lot of the time I spent my year just feeling quite helpless. I think that was a really common feeling that I felt, not just in one or a few days of the year, but I think a lot of the year, whether that was the bushfires, I remember we talked about that in one of our episodes, of just feeling like so helpless, like there's nothing that we can do to help. Obviously there were ways, but I think in the grand scheme of things, we just felt so like, you know, we're watching houses burning, we're watching nature get destroyed, watching animals just be totally wiped out and species. And that I think was really hard to watch. And I think also carrying through with COVID, with everything else that happened this year, I just felt really helpless, I think. And I think that for me was a feeling that I couldn't shake. And I don't think I realized it until I was really reflecting today when I was preparing this app. It was just helpless. Just there's nothing I can do about this. I mean, sure, there are some things that you can do, but I think overall I just felt like, oh, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to help people. I just want to help everyone. So I think that would be my pit. And I think my peak was definitely my hens weekend that I had with you, Ames, and all the others. I had such a fun weekend and a bit of a getaway from everything that happened this year. And it was just so nice to just disconnect. I think I hadn't done that all year, and just to totally switch off was so nice. So yes, that would definitely be my peak of the year. Amy, tell me your pit and peak of the year.
Oh, okay. Like you said, it's really, really hard to narrow it down to just a couple. And I think if I had to describe the year that has been 2020, I'd say it's been really unrelenting and remorseless. It has felt like a never-ending marathon that has strained us to a place of fatigue that we probably have never experienced before. And I think that is probably been my pit, is just feeling tired like I have never felt tired before. I don't think I have ever experienced burnout personally. I've definitely worked with clients who have experienced burnt out and prolonged stress, but I don't think I've ever felt this level of exhaustion before. Mm. And I mean, mental fatigue. I think just because of the intensity of work and everything that we have had go on this year, as you know, great as this year has been for us in some things that we have done, like starting our business, some potty goals that we have had, I've moved house, and those are all great things. And I think maybe that has led to some conflicting feelings of, oh, you know, I shouldn't be tired because I'm being productive. And I think maybe that is one of the biggest things that I've learned, is that it is okay not to be productive, and you definitely do need rest. And that is something that I often remind clients of. But I think this year more than ever, I've really had to take my own advice, which is something that, you know, as clinicians, we might struggle to do. But I think nothing about this year has been normal. It's been a really, really weird year. The world this year has changed, and I think we experienced more uncertainty, or certainly in my life, than perhaps a lot of us have had the capacity to cope with. Yet, quite remarkably, here we are. I feel it has been the year of the blind leading the blind in a perpetual state of not knowing. But despite, you know, the ever pervasive fears of uncertainty, like you're explaining, Kat, following catastrophic bushfires, flooding in Australia at the beginning of the year, to a life-threatening global pandemic, I have been in absolute awe of how a lot of people have been or remained caring and kind and compassionate and courageous. But I think only now that we are at the end of the year are we able to kind of have that optimistic view, or especially me, similar to you, Kat, in reflecting upon preparing for this episode. I think it has been such a turbulent series of devastating events since December last year, so for a full 12 months, that I think only now are we able to really reflect and be like, wow, actually people are really incredible. Mm-hmm. And I continue to be in awe of people. I also think there is, you know, an extensive turn of events we have faced in 2020 that feels like the longest and shortest year of my life simultaneously. The magnitude of events that have transpired in just 12 months has made time feel like how it would be described in a philosophy class, like it's an empty container open to individual interpretation. And it's just kind of turned to mush, and I don't really know.
Time has no construct.
It doesn't.
The limit does not exist.
Exactly right. I think that's how a lot of this year has felt. And I think maybe too, one of my pits has been that we have missed so many family and friends' birthday celebration and milestones. Like this year was meant to be your wedding, Kat. And, you know, I think the loss for small businesses and other events that we've been really looking forward to, which maybe we've always took for granted, and then goes back to my optimistic reflection of, wow, how much we appreciate those simple, small things now. And I think maybe that's my peak, is just how grateful I am and appreciative I am that my 2020 has actually been a pretty great year, despite everything that has happened, is that I have learnt so much, and I am very, very appreciative for the year that I have had, despite stress and struggle, which many, many, many of us have shared and had much worse. So yeah, I think my pit in that really long kind of spiral of my little thought tangent there would be, my peak is that I'm very grateful and appreciative for my 2020.
Of course, this year has been really tough on people, but I think it's so easy to get caught up and think, oh, you know, it's been a really awful year, and it definitely has. But it's also good to look at things that have gone well and things that have gone right and things that you have learned. I think you're absolutely right. AMCC has tested us like no other year, and sometimes taking perspective can be such a helpful way to look at it, and such a, you know, optimistic and often realistic way to bring things into perspective. And I think it's just been a year of uneasiness, I think is another word, just really uncertain and just annoying. And oh, and I think that feeling in the pit of everyone's stomach, you know, it's not just a few people who have felt that anxiety. I think a lot of people have. I know even for myself, I
something that I work with a lot, and mostly my presenting issue that clients will come to me about is help for their anxiety. And even for someone like me, I still felt quite anxious this year. And I always think, like, come on, like, Kat, like, you're the one that helps people. Like, you shouldn't be feeling anxious. But I think I just want to normalize the uneasiness of this year. And I think everybody felt it in some way, shape, or form. So it's just been a year. It's just been such a difficult year. And I find that all years are difficult. I think everyone goes through their roller coaster each year, but this year especially hasn't made it any easier on us.
No, not at all. Kat, what do you think 2020 has taught you?
It's a really good question. I think 2020 has just taught me to slow down. And ironically, I did the opposite this year. And I think that's why I'm reflecting on it so much. Remember how I talked about La Dolce Vita? That has really stuck with me. And I really, really, really want to focus on that because, you know, life goes so quickly. I have lost a few clients this year. I know a few people who have passed away this year. And I think every time that happens, I get that reminder. But I want that to be an everyday reminder. I don't want it to be a every few months reminder that life is so short. And, you know, when you have the option of working back late or having dinner with your partner or seeing your girlfriends or, you know, just spending time for yourself or seeing your family, I've really noticed that it's always, for me, I'm really trying to prioritize to spend and connect with people and spend time with people, not do more work, because I feel like I'm never going to look back and be like, oh, I'm so glad that I worked overtime and made that extra amount of money. But I think I'd always be like, I'm so glad I spent time with that person, because you just don't know what will happen. And I think for me, slowing down and stopping and spending time on me, spending time with Josh, spending time with my girlfriends, and quality time, like not being quite mindful, that's something I really need to work on. So that's something that I've learned. What about you, Ames? What's been something that you've learned?
I think I've learned a lot from 2020. I think 2020 being that it has been, you know, or we've had such a magnitude of events in the last 12 months, I have learned a lot. And I have something really simple that I guess has changed a lot for me, or changed the way I see it. And that is to rid myself of guilt for having sick days. Mm-hmm. You know, there is very little that can't wait till tomorrow. And sometimes the most productive thing you can do for yourself is to take a day or a couple, if that's what you need, to really listen to your needs around work, because burnout is real. And I think that is something that a lot of people may have dealt with this year or really struggled with this year. And I think another part of that is to be really flexible with your goals, because as we have learnt, the only constant is change. We can never be sure or never be certain of what tomorrow has to offer us. So be flexible. I think also self-care is not a luxury. It is a necessity. Mm-hmm. We really need to take the time to prioritize self-care. And also I think the value of alone time and reconnecting with yourself. For the first half of this year, I lived by myself in an apartment, and reflecting back on that, it was actually such a great learning period for me, and something that I still really value, having that time to really connect with myself and I guess look at being alone as very different to being lonely. Mm-hmm. I think that is something that we may struggle to differentiate, and being okay with being in your own company is something that maybe a lot of us were forced during isolation to learn how to do. But I think it's a very important life lesson.
Yeah, absolutely. I really love that. Being alone and slowing down has been such a message from 2020, and something that hopefully a lot of people have taken out of 2020. How has, do you think, like, I know that you mentioned burnout, Ames, but this might be interesting to talk about if you want to. How do you feel like your mental health has been this year? Like, do you feel like COVID or anything that's happened this year has impacted on it?
So absolutely. I think, well, I won't speak for everyone. I will just speak for myself. And something that we posted about recently is our window of tolerance. Mm-hmm. So we have an optimal kind of state of where we have capacity to cope with life's ebbs and flows. And if you have experienced trauma or prolonged stress, your window to cope with challenging events or struggles as they come up get smaller. So then we are bumped out of our window of tolerance into either a state of hyper arousal, which feels like fight flight. It may look like aggressiveness, anger, or it might look like a lot of nervous energy, worry, stress, anxiety. And there is only so long that we can be in a state of hyper arousal before we bump down to hypo arousal, which kind of just looks like being numb and dissociating and withdrawn. So again, maybe that goes back to what I was explaining about time just feeling like mush and not really knowing where we are, if we're coming or going. And definitely, I think that is something that I've spoken about with almost every client that I have, and something that I've had to remind myself about too is my tolerance and what I have the capacity to cope with, and to really be aware of my window of tolerance. I think if you're not familiar with the window of tolerance, because it's something that's used a lot in trauma work, then you might be aware of the polyvagal theory. So in our dorsal state, that is what we would call hypoarousal. So when we're feeling quite low and flat and withdrawn or just burnt out, basically, I think is what it feels like. We've kind of just reached our saturation point and we are just not doing so well with the coping of prolonged stress. And absolutely, that is something that I've experienced, because I think at a certain point something has to give. And I think having unrelenting expectations as well plays into that. Is you might be trying to keep a clean house and do your best at work every day and go to the gym or work out, eat as best you can, and look after your clients, look after your partner, reach out to your family members, and continuously trying to keep that up does get a bit exhausting. And I guess you do reach a point of fatigue where I guess you probably have to take a step back and really prioritize what your needs are to look after yourself so that you can keep looking after for others. And I think perhaps that was something that I definitely experienced this year. What about you, Kat?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Ames. We've had such a reduced amount of what we should be putting pressure on ourselves to do, right? Like, I think considering our year, it's okay if you didn't reach those goals, or it's okay if you didn't keep up the gym. I know that's something that I haven't been doing, and I've been so frustrated at myself that I haven't. And I have to sometimes think like, girl, you're probably burnt out. Like, you're probably approaching that really exhaustive phase of burnout, or, you've just had so much happen this year. Like, and I think that I won't be the only one experiencing that, Ames. I know you have. It's just like, instead of focusing on what I haven't done this year, it's like, well, let's look at what we have been able to do. And if I get out of bed today, and if I, go for a walk, then awesome. Or if I can connect to a friend, or if I have some self-care time, like, that is fantastic. It's about looking at what we can do rather than getting frustrated and angry of what we didn't do this year, or what we should be doing, or, trying to keep up all of those things that we were doing previously. And I think also end of year is naturally a time where people's energies dip and start to get excited for the holidays and switch off from, all of the grind that we've done throughout the year. So I think naturally this time of year as well, everyone's just starting to feel a bit like ready for holidays. And a lot of people have skipped their mid-year holidays, and that's usually a time to recharge and, kind of fill your cup up. But I think this year people have just kind of said, well, it's COVID, so I may as well just keep on working through, or they've been forced to take leave, but it has been stressful leave. So it hasn't been a recharging, relaxing leave break. It's been, maybe people have felt, oh, in this time, will I go back to my job? Will they still have my job there? Or have I lost my job? My job keeper? That's not leave. That's not relaxing. That's actually quite stressful. So I think even if people were on leave or didn't, were on job keeper or lost their job, that's not a time to recharge. A lot of people probably felt even more stress being out of work than in it. So I think, this year has not given us much time to actually switch off and recharge and feel comfortable and safe to do so. I think a lot of us have been stuck in that fight or flight, which means switching off is so hard.
Absolutely. And I think another thing that's really contributed to that is comparison. I think a lot of people, myself included, have, you know, really been stuck in that comparison trap where it's like, well, you know, so-and-so has been able to go to the gym and still keep up their regular routine and they are coping okay. So, you know, why can't I? And I think that is something that is so important to remind yourself, that everything is relative, that, you know, everyone has their own battles that they are fighting that we might not know about. So I think definitely there are a couple of things is going back to basics and practicing self-compassion. Exactly like you said, Kat, that if you're able to get up out of bed and, you know, take a slow morning or go for a walk, doing something for yourself, that is being productive. I think I've really taken on a whole new meaning of what it means to be productive, and really listening to your needs and attuning to your body and what you need and your mental health as well. But yeah, comparison has been a really big thing that I have noticed both myself and for my clients, that I guess social media plays a big part in too, like going back to the gym example, at home workouts and, you know, do an at home workout every day, keep up with your gym routine. I think eating has been another big thing for people too, and being smacked out of routine with everything that has been 2020 and maybe falling off the wagon in your healthy eating patterns or healthy eating habits, and maybe going for foods that you wouldn't usually go for, and certain things like that, which can maybe wreak havoc on how you're perceiving yourself. I know definitely for me, that's something that I've felt quite stressed about is, well, I'm not going to the gym as much as I usually do, and I'm not eating the way I usually do, and worrying about that. And I don't think I'm alone in those anxieties. I think that's something that a lot of people have worried about. And I think the term, what was it, ISO body, or was it ISO body?
I don't know. I haven't heard that.
Oh, I remember seeing a meme, and I think 2020 has been amazing for memes, but absolutely horrible for mental health.
There's ISO skin. I know ISO skin. But ISO body, I mean.
ISO body. And I remember for my birthday, heaps of people got me, like, you got me this beautiful cake and people sent me donuts and everything, and it was beautiful. But I remember someone made a joke and they were like, oh, how heavy are you going to roll out of 2020 or something? And I was like, oh my goodness. And that I've seen a lot of memes that have been about gaining weight in isolation and throughout COVID. And I know that is an anxiety that a lot of people have battled with. And I just think part of social media has played a really damaging role in, you know, that if you, so what if you gained a couple of extra kilos? Yeah. And I think going through this pandemic and everything else that 2020 has thrown at it, I think the least important thing is whether you have gained weight or not. And that is something that I most definitely have had to remind myself about, being that I am human and I am not perfect, and practicing self-compassion and giving myself permission that it is okay if I skip a workout to catch up on some sleep that I need, or to take a slow morning to manage my stress, or, you know, just to spend a little bit of extra time maybe reading or doing something that is going to really nurture my needs. And I guess, yeah, I'm being a little bit raw and honest in admitting that, which is maybe something that I find hard to do, but it is something that I have definitely related to other people sharing throughout their 2020.
Well, thank you for being raw and honest, Ames. That is certainly such a normal feeling. And you know what? Speaking of comparison, I feel like for people that don't know Amy, she is a workhorse. Trust me when I look at her calendar, because I have access to her calendar, it stresses me out just looking at it. And you, Ames, you're busy. You like thrive in busyness. I think like sometimes I look at your calendar, Ames, and be like, I'd like to be to Josh. I was like, oh, I'm a bit worried about Ames this week. Like, is she okay? Because Ames, you work at like 150%. And with comparison, I think since starting a business with you, I would be like, how does AIMS do so much? And I do half of that and I'm exhausted. And I think that's the other side of it, isn't it? It's like you were probably spending so much time working. I know you're absolutely killing it with clients and you're so busy. And I think like I would be comparing myself in that respect because I'd be like, oh my goodness, she is just working her butt off. And I think that that is also goes
and
to
I
show-
likewise to you.
No, I think that goes to show that something I've also learned is that people can do more than you and that's okay. It doesn't mean you have to. And I would always look at you and be like to Josh, I was like, how does she do this? I'm also like, as part of it, it's like, I'm kind of worried about her that she's got a crack. And I remember talking to Andy, just leave the country or something. And I remember talking to Andy and I was like, hey, like, cause you would never tell me if you were really stressed, you're just like, everything's fine. And I was like, hey, Andy, is Ames okay? Like, I'm just a bit worried about it. He goes, yeah, she's fine. She loves it. I was like, what?
I do.
So stressed.
And I do. And I absolutely am okay. Like I said, I think this year has really taught me to prioritize because you cannot do everything all at once. You are not a jar of Nutella. You can't make everyone happy all the time. And that is okay. I said, going back to basics, being compassionate to yourself and something that you and I both preach so much and something that I've really, really had to take our advice on this year. And so like I say, maybe feeling like other areas of life have had to take a back seat, like gym and like, you know, spending hours on meal prep and things like that would usually be a priority for me. I've had to really negotiate with myself and be like, okay, so all I can manage this week is this and I will be okay with the rest because that aligns to my values and that's what I need to focus on this week. Everything else is okay. It's not a necessity. It's not a priority. And giving myself those little pep talks.
I love that. That's so true, Ames, because, you know, we always say balance. It's never always perfect every day. It might have just one day where you focus so much on work and then everything, other things might drop. And then the other day it's everything else picks up. You don't focus on work and balance. It's never a perfect pie cut into five slices where everything gets a perfect amount of time each day. It's always so different. And I think this year, maybe balance has gone out the window, people working from home, there isn't that routine, there's not the familiarity of work and exercise, you know, people had to stay inside. So I think so much went out the window and I think touching on your, I guess, talking about your body and how you perceive it, I think that that's so normal. I think not just women, among men and obviously gender binary people have had this really overarching just concern and preoccupation with their body, right? Because when we're stressed, we generally eat or we don't eat. And that generally leads to us being unhappy with our body. And, you know, we've had time to look at our body a lot, haven't we? We haven't been out of the house. We haven't been occupied. So when you're in lockdown, especially our Victorian family, I just, you know, I think that preoccupation and frustration, anxieties with bodies are so normal. And self-esteem, I think, as a whole, especially coming out of lockdown into the festive season and into summer, you know, I think that that's so normal and so okay. Ames was right. The least important thing about you is your weight. And that always is the case. The least important thing and interesting thing about you is how much you weigh or if you've gained or lost weight. But I think it's so normal to be feeling those things coming into the festive season. Like it's not even like we're going into winter, and, you know, we're in hiding. It's like, hello, 700 Christmas parties, birthdays, catching up from all the lost time.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I couldn't have said it better myself. And another thing too, that I think 2020 has really highlighted is how important your support network is, how important connecting is to friends, to family, to colleagues, to everyone within your circle. You know, I've seen in my professional setting, within my friendship group, within family, just how important our relationships have been throughout this really turbulent year. And definitely my appreciation for my support network has just tripled. I already appreciate the beautiful people that I have in my life, but I think just this year more than ever has really made me
reflect on how much I love and appreciate the people in my life, like you, Kat, as a business partner, as a friend, as a...
You can never leave me now.
Non-related sister, as a soul sister, and all our other beautiful friends. Like, I think too, just people that you know, you're close with, but you maybe have not considered within your tight circle of friends. I have been really pleasantly surprised at some of the people that have reached out and just shown such beautiful kindness and, you know, care throughout this time. And that has just been something that I've been really, really grateful for. And one little tip that I have, or one little piece of advice, not even as a clinician, but just as another person, that I would say is, if you haven't already expressed how grateful you are for the support that you have in your life, I think that that is invaluable. Some of the messages that I have received from friends, from clients, from colleagues about their appreciation has honestly just giving me goosebumps and giving me the warm and fuzzy feelings. And I think that that just is free and takes 10 seconds and you remember those words. And I think in a year that has been very heavy on the negative, it is so nice to get those little positive reinforcements that you've been a great friend or you've been a great support for someone. So definitely tell your loved ones that you appreciate them, and reach out, and yeah, I think that's important.
I love that. That is so true and so quick to do as well. It can make someone's whole week or year. And also, I think being in this job, like, I don't know if you feel the same. I think you do. I think we've spoken about this previously. Like, I'm pretty sure we have had this exact conversation. I'm just going to pretend like it's a new one. In this job, I don't know, since we've opened the site collaborative, I just feel every time that I talk to a client, and obviously in my normal job as well, but I think particularly with the site collaborative, I just am so honored. Like, I just, I don't know if you ever feel the same when people thank you and you think, no, like, thank you for, you know, opening up to me with your story and trusting me. And I think that that means so much. And someone asked me the other day, they said, I don't know how you do it. And I said, well, you know, it's because I'm so grateful. Like, I just feel every time I have a session with a client, it's a little bit corny, but I'm going to bring it anyway because that's who I am as a person. I just feel like, wow, like, I'm so happy to be helping that person. I'm so happy that we can help people in this job. Yes, it is definitely a very, a job that needs a lot more holidays, but so grateful for the job that we have and the clients we have. And shout out to our site collaborative clients. We absolutely adore you guys. We are so impressed that our clients have put their mental health first. So just love that for us. It's been a really tricky year, but I think that's definitely been actually one of my other peaks, is the site collaborative, especially opening a business with you, Ames, is just one of the best. It's just been one of the best things we've done this year. So
yeah,
shout out to you and our amazing clients that we have.
Love you. Absolutely. Guys. Absolutely. I often joke to my clients, and I'm sure that they don't laugh, but that, you know, I'm so grateful, exactly like you said, for them allowing me the opportunity to sit with them through their most vulnerable experiences, and that therapy is often like frostbite and that it hurts while it heals, and yet they show up and put in the demanding work while I have the opportunity, the honor, and the privilege to walk with them while they do so. So absolutely, it is, I couldn't have another job, I don't think. And oh, I know, gosh, we've,
I know.
Yeah, lucky.
I know. I think, God, lucky we got into this job. Lucky I didn't keep going in tourism. Oh, gosh.
Alrighty. So we have put up a few questions to get some ballistic statistics from no other than our beautiful listeners and our Instagram followers. And I guess another reason why we wanted to do a little end of year wrap up is to extend our appreciation and our gratitude to you for all your support over the year.
Oh my gosh, Kat and I, yes, you guys.
Yeah.
Amazing listeners, guys. We got that 2020 Spotify Wrapped, okay.
Amy and I are an independent little podcast and we do our best to get episodes up. We did not expect to be number 15 in the health and fitness charts and on Spotify. That's incredible. Huge.
Mind blown.
I said you that like, Amy, I think something's gone wrong here. I think they've miscounted the stats or something like that.
And I think I just sat and stared at my phone for a while in disbelief. Like number 15 out of what? Like New South Wales or?
No, Australia. Yeah. Oh, yeah, Australia. Yeah.
I know, but that's what I was thinking. Like surely not. Like surely not Australia. Like this has to be like a local kind of geographical location based, right? Like they've taken our little geographical pin. They've been like, okay, yeah, in top this 15. Area. Yeah.
In Glenmore Park.
In Penrith.
Look, I mean, I didn't see how many others there were. So it could be 15 out of 15, but we've made top 20. And let's just look at the positives.
Yeah. No, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. From the bottom of our tiny little hearts, we just appreciate each and every single one of you. Like Kat said, we are a very small independent potty and we just... Every time we get a little bit of feedback from one of our lovely listeners and you send us these beautiful, beautiful messages of, you know, how an episode might have shown you insight or you might have connected with something that we've said or you've learnt something. That is why we do this and it makes our day. It gives us so much motivation to keep putting out content for you. You know, the reason that Kat and I started this podcast is because we understand the gap between, I guess, good psychological information and support, even though this platform isn't intended as support, I guess certain parts of this podcast can help you in some way, maybe just, you know, giving you a little bit more understanding and maybe connecting you or giving you the confidence to reach out for support. I know that's something that a lot of people have really gained is just that's something that we are so passionate about is breaking the stigma for accessing psychological support. It should be just as normal as going to the gym or just as normal as going to the dentist. And I think I've lost my train of thought, but thank you.
Oh, I agree. We've had such a year and obviously Ames and I have started a business that we did not expect to go quite as well as it did. So the potty had to be put on the back burner just for a few weeks, but we will be back next year doing.
We've got some sweet ideas.
I want to put them out to the universe, but you know what? We need to put them on the board.
Yeah. Once it's on the board, it will come true. Anyway, we digress. Thank you, beautiful people. We popped up some questions about 2020.
We wanted to get some statistics because obviously I was looking for, you know, just some statistics about this episode, just about the overall general mental health trends from 2020. Obviously, because it's only December, the official trends haven't come out. So I thought, what better credible place to get our statistics from than Instagram? A little bit biased target market. But so we just wanted to get some quick statistics and please take these with a grain of salt. They are not, or they're not going to reflect on the whole population, but it might just be good to get some general understanding of patterns of mental health.
Absolutely. So here are a few things that 2020 has taught our beautiful Instagram followers.
The first one was a great one. And something that this person has learned is to start with 10 minutes of self-care every day. I really love that.
Love that. The next one is put yourself first.
We spoke about that. Definitely good to put yourself first. Okay. The third one is, and I think this is going to be a common thread for a lot of women out there. Men can't be trusted. 2020 has been tough on relationships. Can I just say?
I was going to say 2020 has really tested relationships.
Yeah. Okay. Next one.
2020 has taught me that it's okay to take medication for mental health.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. I love that. Okay. 2020 has taught me that life can change so quickly and suddenly. So don't wait until you're old to start a bucket list. I love that one.
That life is unpredictable and you appreciate the positive aspects of life.
Oh God, I love our listeners. They're like hype girls. I wonder if there's any hype men in there. 2020 has taught me about resilience and what matters in life.
Lovely. 2020 has taught me that you can plan all you want, but life will just happen and you have to go with it.
Yes.
Okay, 2020 has taught me to slow down and get help if you need it. Yes, absolutely.
Absolutely. The next one, to get help as soon as possible.
Mm-hmm. That I don't have to hide who I am. I love that. How beautiful.
That is so beautiful. Love that. The next one, it has taught me how to be patient with life and daily tasks.
Yes.
Oh, that speaks to my soul, to be patient. Because God knows I really lack patience. And absolutely, that is something that I have really had to practicing patience.
People say it's a virtue. Okay. 2020 has taught me that excellent strategies and techniques for anxiety and depression. Love that.
2020 has taught me to take one day at a time.
You really can't do anything else other than that, can we? Mm-mm. 2020 has taught me about resilience. It's okay to not be okay, and vulnerability is the best way to grow. God, I love these guys. I wanna have dinner with all of these people.
I know. 2020 has taught me the true value of support networks. Amen, sister.
Amen. All right. So we also did some quick little stats of whether the year that was has impacted on people's mental health more than usual. So out of the last 20 minutes since we've put this up, 81% of the respondents have said that this year has impacted negatively on their mental health. And out of those 81%, 94% have said that this year has increased their anxiety, depression, and stress more than usual.
Wow.
That's a really big statistic. I mean, I'm not shocked, but that's a really big statistic.
That is really big. And then the next thing we asked our lovely listeners is to describe your 2020 in one word. And wow, we had a lot of people respond to this. Some of your words were draining, eye-opening, exhausting, fucked, draining, tumultuous, fluctuating, overwhelming, shit show, colorful, evolved, busy, roller coaster, two words, sorry. It's okay. We'll allow it. Empowering, growth, a lot.
It was a lot. It was a That's lot. That's such a good way to describe it. It's just a lot, as Abby Chatfield says. It's just a lot.
We love Abby. Overwhelming, unsettled, fucked, chaotic, growth.
Love these guys.
Revealing and fucked. Fucked.
I think the overwhelming response is 2020 was fucked.
2020 has been fucked.
Can you put the this verdict in the IGTV? Yeah. Run some quick statistics. We have discovered that 2020 is indeed fucked. Oh gosh. Well, guys, we appreciate your responses. They will keep coming in. We should actually post them once we've given everyone 24 hours to respond. That would actually be really good to kind of be like, guys, these are the words that you said and you all feel fucked.
Can we please make that the title for this podcast, 2020 was fucked?
Yes, absolutely we will. Absolutely. It's our last episode. We're allowed to be a little unprofessional, right? Push those boundaries.
You know what? I was listening back because I wanted to post something on Instagram, not because I just sit and listen to my own podcast.
Yes,
or our
so
podcast.
Do.
I really don't. But I was listening back to some earlier episodes and we were so profesh. We were so, I don't know what the word is, because it escapes. It escapes me now, because that's not how we are on our podcast anymore. I feel like we're much more casual and much more chill. We've really evolved in our podcasting style,
yeah,
haven't we?
We have. I think when we first started though, I mean, these two little clinicians just not wanting to put a foot out of line. I think in our field of work, you don't want to say or do the wrong thing because it is such a vulnerable topic. But I think that people do like, and that's also us. We're very informal. We're very casual. We joke around a lot. And I think, yes, we need to be professional, but it's good to be a little bit more casual and relatable as well. And people have said that. I think that's also why people just enjoy us being us, and having that really normal conversational delivery. I think people really like it. It's a good little mix, I think. I think we do both hopefully. Things quite well. Hopefully.
We try.
I mean, we are number 15, so... I mean, obviously, we're kind of a big deal. I got an email the other day, actually. So sorry, it's such a tangent. We are number one in Bulgaria.
Bulgaria.
Mental health. So to all our Bulgarian listeners, hello. We see you. We love you. Thank you. Thanks for the listens.
Amazing.
All right. We are answering some listener questions. We actually got quite a few, as we always do. So we'll try and do our best to answer all of them. And obviously, guys, remember, these are not personalized advice. This is not in replacement of personalized psychological therapy. This is more for just for general informational purposes. So Amy, start us off.
Alrighty. First question we got is, how can I be more vulnerable in life? I never talk about my feelings and I can't help blocking off.
Wow, this is actually such a common feeling. And I don't know if that's just because I work a lot with these people that I have experienced that vulnerability, it's not an easy thing to express, is it? And I think that this person is not alone in, you know, feeling nervous to talk about how they're feeling or feeling vulnerable. I would say that the fear of vulnerability is likely to make, it can often stem from a past rejection, when maybe that person was trying to express their feelings or be vulnerable. So I think exploring that, I guess, when did your feelings of vulnerability start? Maybe it was from a caregiver or a friend or an ex-partner. Those things can be really good to explore of, you know, just kind of where it all started and what the trigger was. I think another thing I was going to say to this question is just starting small. You know, you don't have to go and tell one person everything. I think sometimes something that can help if you have fear of opening up is writing down your vulnerabilities, you know, just a list, a dot point of just things that you want to, how you're feeling, and talking about, you know, connecting with how you're feeling. Again, likely you've had a pretty good coping mechanism to block it off, to talking about your feelings. So just reconnecting with yourself, labeling exactly how you're feeling, what thoughts are coming to your mind, how that makes you feel, how does it feel in your body. Those things can be such a quick, effective step to starting to connect back to yourself and how you're feeling, and not try and block things off. So I would say start small, write things down, even draw them. If you're not someone that feels comfortable writing or just isn't sure, drawing your feelings, seeing if you can get anything out of that. That's something I would recommend.
Yeah, I love that answer, Kat. I guess the only thing I would add to that is from a little bit more of an attachment perspective and understanding the two forms of attachment insecurity being anxiety and avoidance. And it sounds like perhaps if we are avoiding vulnerability, I guess there is, you know, association with unique patterns of emotional regulation in response to certain types of threatening or distressing situations. And I think understanding that our earlier experiences as children shape our behavior, and as children we are inherently vulnerable. You know, we rely on our caregivers for everything because we can't do anything for ourselves. So while we need them to feed us and change us, what we really need is to feel loved and safe and wanted. And it's important to remember that these needs don't go away. They don't actually change as we grow up. Yes, we learn to dress ourselves and to go to the bathroom ourselves, but we retain that inner vulnerable child no matter how old we are. So connection is about feeling safe. If we do not feel safe, our protective mechanisms are triggered to protect our vulnerabilities. So if you have learnt maybe that love is not safe, or that people who are meant to meet your needs are inconsistent or cause you pain, vulnerability will be difficult. In this case, we learn not to be vulnerable. We shut down by shutting down to the risks of experiencing pain. But often in doing so, we also shut down to the possibilities later in life of joy, intimacy, closeness, and connection. So attachment is important to look at because it forms how we see ourselves in relationship with others. When people believe themselves worthy of connection, they are more likely to move towards others. So securely attached people will be the first to say, I love you. They'll ask for help, and they'll be open to love and affection and support of others. This doesn't mean that they always get what they want, though. What it means is that they are more willing to be open and vulnerable in relationships because the potential for shame and risk feels less. They have that secure base to come back to. So a secure attachment means that if the connection falls short, if the I love you is left hanging, people still believe that they are worthy of connection and are less likely to blame themselves and their own perceived unworthiness for the disconnection. So they allow themselves to be vulnerable to the uncertainty, and they make it safe for others to do the same. So my recommendation based on that would be turning toward your vulnerability with compassion. Yeah. You know, telling yourself, talking to yourself to nurture your inner child. Notice when your vulnerability is triggered from unmet needs. Learn how to soothe it. Just as a young child needs to be held and cuddled and supported and soothed, we must learn how to do this for our own inner child. I know this can sound a little bit woo-woo. No, you don't have a little child in your belly banging to get out. This can...
Congrats if you're pregnant.
But yeah, this can be very challenging for people who have had these early experiences of being soothed, or for those who have held on to beliefs that vulnerability is bad, or that, you know, their experiences of abuse were their fault. So self-soothing once you've identified your needs, and maybe that's safety, validation, to be seen, to be heard. Learning how you might meet these needs, whether it's expressing the need, asking for help, to self-validate. And then practice treating your vulnerability with care instead of rejecting it or treating it as something that needs to be quickly fixed. Like Pat said, you don't need to go throw out all your deepest, darkest vulnerabilities to someone. I would definitely suggest turning toward your vulnerability first and practicing. Like Kat said, maybe you just focus on sitting with your feelings first.
Yeah. And even, you know, sometimes if you are wanting to tell someone something, if you've got someone certain in mind that you want to tell them maybe something that's quite vulnerable, practicing in the mirror, writing down what you're going to say, you know, having those small prompts can really help as well. Sometimes people who are maybe a bit fearful of being vulnerable just haven't had the practice, are maybe more fearful of the results, so it's more they don't do it. So I think just reminding yourself that it's okay to be vulnerable, it's just a protective mechanism that you might be internalizing things, and that's okay. The right people will be there to help you if you are vulnerable. So just start small, you know, as Ames has said, take it slow. You don't have to tell everyone anything, but just, you know, practicing the mirror, writing it down, practicing in your car on the way to work, what some things you might say.
And if it is something that you're really, really struggling with after practicing and tuning into yourself, seeking some therapeutic support would be really beneficial in, I guess, just allowing more skills and tools in sitting with that discomfort, or if there is some emotional distress around vulnerability, it can be really helpful to learn healthy ways of coping with that emotional distress.
Absolutely. Great answer, my darling Hutto. You should be a therapist.
Funny you say.
Alrighty, next question, Amy. This listener has asked, okay, tips for going red. I have social anxiety disorder, and whenever I look at someone, I go bright red.
Oh, such an insecure, self-conscious feeling. Blushing. I imagine this person means when they say they're going red, that they're referring to that blushing, that feeling that you get when the adrenaline and the cortisol is pumping through your body, when you get that rush of anxiety and it just feels like you want to run. Totally. But unfortunately, there is actually not a lot we can do to get rid of the blushing or turning red in socially anxious situations. But what we can do is we can work on managing the anxiety and how you feel about, I guess, seeing yourself when you turn red, when you blush. So just like most insecurities, it's about accepting that this is a normal part of being human and not judging yourself too harshly. Doing things like taking deep breaths, maybe some progressive muscle relaxation, tensing and releasing to really look after your nervous system and the physiological response, and reminding yourself that this will pass can also be really helpful. You won't be red forever. And perhaps just practicing again and sitting with a little bit of compassion that this is a normal part of being human and, you know, this will pass.
Really good advice. I think it's so normal, isn't it? Especially with social anxiety disorder, to have the somatic responses and reactions, and blushing is just one of those things. And it's, you know, sometimes can be coupled with or accompanied with those automatic negative thoughts, or ants as we call them, you know, such as, oh my gosh, everyone's looking at me, or
people are going to notice how red I am. Something that we might do in therapy is look at those worst case scenarios. So yes, people are looking at you. What is so bad about that? What's terrible about that? Yes, it's embarrassing, but you know, previously people have looked at you and what bad things have happened. Has anything really bad happened? Sometimes going to the worst case scenario and working backwards can sometimes be quite helpful for social anxiety disorder. I think with any anxiety disorder, really working down and calming down that nervous system when you are in fight or flight, particularly in that social situation, as Ames was saying, you really need to be doing your relaxation strategies, because if you are hyper aroused and in that fight or flight, you can't think rationally. You can't sit there and think, okay, I know that I need to do my breathing. You're going to be like, your thoughts are going to be racing. Like there's no clarity when you're in fight or flight. So I think the best, most important and effective thing you can do is always, 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 I say this, I sound like a broken record, start with your relaxation strategies, start to calm down your nervous system, and then think rationally. Start to question, challenge those judgments. Is it so bad? You know, what are some worst case scenarios? Okay, if people are red, is that terrible? Is it terrible if I'm blushing? You know, it's just taking away that there's something wrong with it can be really helpful as well. And by doing that, you take away the power that it has over you. So really good. But I think if this continues and you really are starting to withdraw socially, it's really good to reach out for some help with social anxiety disorder. It's a really tricky one. So definitely make sure you get that support.
Absolutely. And the next question goes hand in hand with this one, I feel, and that is tips for managing anxiety in group social situations. Kat, what would you offer as some information and non-personalized advice around this?
Such a common feeling, and I think especially now coming out of COVID, there is that increased fear of being social, because we were told 3 months ago that we're not allowed to be social if this person is in Australia anyway. So really normal to be feeling like this, especially at this time of year. Especially also it's exacerbated because there is so many events happening. Like it's a very festive season. There's Christmas parties and Christmas, and you're around generally this time of year a lot of people, especially a lot of unfamiliar people or people who aren't, I guess, safe. I think just knowing that it's, you know, anxiety comes from a fear of a lack of control. and knowing that when you're in a group situation, there's not much you can control. What you can control though is who you stand next to, who you can lean on for support. So maybe having that one friend that you can have in those group social situations. Maybe sometimes something that helps me, I know sometimes when I get anxious in those group situations, is asking to go with someone. So you've got that person there and you can walk in together and go to the event together. Like it's more of a practical skill. But yeah, everything we kind of said in the previous question, make sure you're doing your relaxation, challenging those anxious thoughts. So what if, you know, people are judging you, or, you know, what's the worst thing that could happen? And sometimes actually something that might help is taking some time away. So if you need to go to the bathroom, you can sit on the toilet and I say this to my clients, use the bathroom to kind of be your place to calm down, do your deep breaths while you sit on the toilet. Like, I mean, you can do the both if you want to, do some mindfulness, a quick mindfulness. What are some things you can hear and see? You need to get out of that fight or flight. So taking some time away, get a drink of water, going out to a bit of a quieter and outside environment, you're saying that you need to take a call and just maybe calling a support network that isn't there, you know, for example, family or a best friend or your partner. That stuff can be really helpful. So that's what I would recommend.
Absolutely. And acknowledging and self-validating that anxiety is normal, you know, concern about what others think of us is natural. You know, as humans, we are social species. We depend on one another to survive, and fear of negative judgment helps ensure harmony in the pack from evolutionary theory. I also think it can be helpful to just breathe. As Kat was saying, really focus on calming down your nervous system and practice breathing. So maybe even before you get there, take 5 to 10 really slow paced breaths and breathe, and really focus on your breath. I think maybe shift your focus too when you are there. So I think anxiety can sometimes turn our attention inward, and you know, we can, like I was saying, focus on all the really negative things, we might start catastrophizing or fortune telling or those, you know, automatic negative thoughts and thinking traps, like Kat was saying. So I think as anxiety continues to build, focusing on neutral factors, you know, like color and texture and what the decor is like. I know it sounds really, really silly, but shifting your focus will interrupt the anxiety cycle and just let you ground in the here and now and what's happening. I also think celebrating you pushing yourself in discomfort. Mm. So if you are someone that experiences social anxiety and you are just showing up to a social event, that is something to celebrate. That is something to be really proud of, and celebrating those small wins, that you are being really brave and facing your fears, noticing your anxiety and trying your best to manage it and being willing to stand in that hurricane to do what you think is important is something to be celebrated. So do that often.
Okay. We've also done a potty on social anxiety, so that might be good to listen to as well if you're you know, just feeling unsure of maybe some why you are feeling like that and what are some things you can do. So we've done a whole episode, so we would recommend going and having a little listen. Ames, next question. Tips on reconnecting in a relationship after a break?
Okay. There is, I would say, a lot of controversy around whether breaks are a good or bad thing in a relationship, but perhaps not the most relevant because you've already taken the break. So tips after a break, the positives around breaks, I guess, is that they give you time to calm down, deepen perspective, and maybe have a do-over with your partner when conflict may have gotten to the point of trouble to repair. So in times when you've pushed each other past your partner's threshold of tolerance, we can kind of get locked in that stonewalling stalemate. So Dr. John Gottman is amazing. He is a psychiatrist who specializes in relationships, and he termed this concept called self-righteous indignation, which is kind of this obsessing over wrongs we believe our partner has committed. And this can happen silently as we ruminate internally, or it can be something that we vent about to our partner or others. So when we fall into this self-righteous indignation, our partner becomes the problem. As mammals, we have evolved to be acutely aware of one another's nonverbal cues. So this looks like eye rolling, avoidance of eye contact, loud sighs, and that dismissiveness. And these signs all communicate contempt and disdain, which slowly erode intimacy and trust and all that good stuff in a relationship. So taking space can support your relationship and bring you closer together. We can move beyond that state of blame, and, you know, we can really give ourselves a chance to recover from flooding. I think when it comes to reconnecting, listening non-defensively is really important. So finding a reasonable complaint or opinion and offering assurance, you know, practicing those positive nonverbal cues. So rather than eye rolling, if you don't agree with something, just nodding your head and maintaining eye contact can really help have a productive conversation. I think once you recognize that a break needs to happen, what you do with it will determine whether the time apart will be beneficial. So navigating a relational turmoil solo can stir up a lot of emotions, even if you are the one who initiated the space. It's not uncommon to find yourself feeling rejected or hypervigilant and self-protected. So both mindsets can really stop you from reconnecting with your partner. So that's really important too, to be mindful of. And for this reason, I think it's really important that during a timeout to intentionally cease any negative comments about your partner. So I think one mistake that some people tend to make is going to their friends maybe and really venting quite negatively and quite harshly about their partner, maybe all the things that they think their partner's done wrong. Instead, try to consciously cultivate that, you know, respect to the idea that you know, there may be more to the picture than what you are seeing and feeling from your angered or hurt or rejected point, because that's your perspective. So for a break to succeed, refrain from venting to others really negatively and instead channel that into something unrelated. You know, go for a walk, do something that takes your mind away from the conflict. And I think while engaged in this other activity for your mind that maybe latches onto anger or fear, will allow yourself to let that go intentionally and maybe help you consider that rather than focusing on who is right or wrong, that there are two views and both can be valid. So coming back together and trying again, I would say if the break turns into a prolonged silence, that can really do damage. So there then becomes issues of power and control, and that can really be played out. So try not to get stuck with, you know, who initiates what and who contacts who first. Instead, focus on reconnecting sooner if possible. And people who are successful in doing that, I guess, really don't emphasize blame. They understand that conflict, you know, is one of those things, and handle their disagreements maybe using something like I statement. So I felt really hurt when. I think learning to stay calm in the face of threat and conflict is definitely not easy, but it's something that will really help you when you connect. And I think another thing that's really important, sorry, I know I'm going on a really long tangent, but struggling to answer this question, snappy. One thing that I think is also really, really important is how couples recall memories and their stories they tell. So memories are malleable, they're not static, they evolve and they change. And when a relationship is coming to the end or coming to a break, we may really struggle to have those warm, fuzzy feelings and narratives that we once had for our partner, and a new narrative evolves, which enhances your partner's negative traits, and it quite likely minimizes your own. So we are meaning-making machines, and anytime something bad happens, we scramble to make up a story, and our brain doesn't care if it's right or wrong. So when a story has limited data points, it is a conspiracy. And Kat, you might know this bias as the fundamental attribution error, where we are very partial to giving ourselves a pass and thinking we can do no wrong while not doing the same for others. So by seeing ourselves as a victim, we are no longer an ally with our relationship, but we see our partner as the enemy. And we can't assume our communication, our memory, and our perception is truth. It is just one perspective. So I think that is really, really important to remember while trying to reconnect after a break, especially if you are struggling to get over a perpetual problem or challenge in the relationship.
Very well said. There is nothing that
sorry. I can add to that. I was like, as I started talking, I was like, and this, and this, and this.
No, love the information, girlfriend.
Okay. The next question is, what impact do hormones have with the pill feeling very low?
Really good question. Ames and I have done an episode on this. I think it would be better. It's really hard to articulate the question, the answer to this, because it is Q&A. Essentially, hormonal imbalances can wreak havoc on our cortisol, on it can alter our brain function, impair lots of cognitive functioning. So hormonal imbalances can absolutely negatively affect mood and energy, but there is just a lot of detail. So we did a really good ep, Is the Pill Making Me Crazy? Is that what it was called? It was in season two.
I think it's in season one.
Season one. God, we put out some bangers in season one,
didn't we? We really did.
So I would recommend to go and have a listen to that. We go into a whole lot of detail about it. I guess just normalizing the impact of mental health and feeling low on the pill. So I would recommend to go and have a listen to that.
Absolutely. And I think one of the reasons we recorded an entire episode is because, Kat, you and I are very passionate about educating people on this topic. One, because it's so understudied. And two, because we are so ill-informed when it comes to being prescribed the pill as to the psychological side effects that we might experience. You know, the pill is essentially synthetic hormones, you know, that act on estrogen and progesterone receptors. And this has so many downstream actions. I think it's really important to remember that ovarian hormones have excitatory and inhibitory effects on various neurotransmitters. Both estrogen and progesterone influence the brain in many different ways. God, I'm getting tongue-tied with all these words. It is. But yeah, there is definitely a correlation between the pill and depression, and contraceptive pills also cause low mood, anxiety, irritability, lower stress tolerance, tearfulness. There is an absolute abundance of side effects and numerous impacts that the pill can have on our mental health. So definitely give that one a listen. As Kat said, it does require a lot of detail to really go into. So that is why we recorded a whole episode on it.
Yeah, it was a goodie. Okay, next question, Ames. How do anti-anxiety medications, also known as antidepressants, work, in particular SNRIs?
Okay, so I am not a psychiatrist, which is who I would recommend consulting with when it comes to serotonin and norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors, or SNRIs, as they are a class of medications that are effective in treating depression usually and symptoms of anxiety and panic. What I do know is that they work by influencing our serotonin and norepinephrine by preventing a person's brain cells from absorbing neurotransmitters, so ultimately affecting changes in brain chemistry and the communication between brain nerve cell circuitry. So that's how they regulate mood. So basically they block the reabsorption or the reuptake to the neurotransmitter serotonin and norepinephrine in the brain. But yeah, if you are someone who is thinking about taking medication, I would definitely consult with your doctor and get a referral to a psychiatrist so you can have a full assessment and evaluation, because there is a lot that goes into prescribing medication, especially when it comes to SSRIs or SNRIs.
Yeah, and I think it's good to get a really comprehensive review, because SSRIs, SNRIs, and also other things like benzodiazepine and GABA blockers, they do different, I mean, they work in the same way, but they can have different side effects. They can interact with other medications. So it's really important to make sure that you've got a really good GP or get that referral to a psychiatrist who can look at all that stuff for you. Essentially, when you are suffering from anxiety and depression, your neurotransmitters aren't communicating as well as someone who isn't suffering from anxiety, depression, has a quote normal brain. So what medications do is seek to increase the communication and almost regulate the chemicals in your brain and the neurotransmitters or the hormones such as serotonin, you know, and cortisol and things like that. So they're just kind of trying to balance out those brain chemicals. So I think, but as we're saying, the best thing you can do is to get that. And research can be good. I think medications are good to research. But also I think just having that GP or psychiatrist who can help you further, and they can also help you to understand it as well.
Absolutely. And remembering that everyone is so different. You are a unique individual. So what another person might have found really effective in managing their depression or anxiety, you might have a completely different prescription and treatment plan. So always recommend, as Kat said, a full comprehensive assessment and evaluation when it comes to any treatment of any kind.
Absolutely. Okay, next question. Amy, how do I stop feeling dissociated? I want to feel present again.
Oh, this question sounds so simple for such a complex issue. I think very, very simply put, and there will be no right way to answer this question. It will depend on the individual, but basically dissociation is the brain's way of protecting you from overwhelm, pain, discomfort. It's important to remember that this means in the short term, dissociation was necessary for your survival. When people are dissociating, they, you know, disconnect or detach from their body, emotions and or surroundings, which can numb the trauma that they might have experienced or lower the fear, anxiety or shame that they might be dissociating from. So dissociation can happen during the trauma or later on when thinking about or being reminded of traumatic events. And when dissociation is connected to trauma, memories or reminders, it is considered an avoidance coping strategy. So there's a difference from active avoidance on purpose, avoiding thinking about or doing something, and dissociation tends to happen without awareness. So it's an unconscious coping strategy. And for many, there's a sense of that emotional numbing. So just feeling kind of meh about things that might to other people be emotionally intense. So I would recommend a key strategy to deal with dissociation is grounding. So grounding means connecting back to the here and now, the present. That might look like your five senses grounding technique. So things that you can see, hear, feel, taste, count how many blue items you can see in the room, name animals that begin with the first five letters of the alphabet, techniques like that to really practice being present.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think absolutely just knowing where this came from or where it started, as Ames was saying, could be a manifestation of trauma. It could be the early indication of a clinical diagnosis. Dissociation is quite common in depression, in schizophrenia and in bipolar. So obviously we're not suggesting that, but just to be aware of where this has come from, when did it start, what other symptoms you have. And it can just be that protection from, you know, pain or hurt from the past, or maybe an indication of something else. So I think with this question, I saw it and I thought, I think this is important to maybe reach out for some help.
Yeah.
Just because dissociation can be quite mild or minor and it can happen quite briefly, or it can be long-term. And I think if this is a long-term feeling for you, it's really important that you do reach out for help. Mindfulness is fabulous. Grounding techniques, fabulous. Sleep also really helps with feeling a lot more present. But I think this is certainly something where I think there maybe needs to be some intervention. So we would gently recommend reaching out for some support if you continue to feel this disassociation with your environment and others around you.
Absolutely. Next question is, how should I approach an emotionally unavailable partner?
It's a really good question. Okay, so how do I approach an emotionally unavailable partner? I think one thing is just acknowledge that this person may not have the vocabulary or the feelings of safety to talk about their feelings, and that is okay. You cannot push someone to open up. Generally, if you do, they will resist and if anything, internalize and shut down more. So I think it's about setting up the best possible environment for this to happen, but not expecting miracles. I think it's about approaching it collaboratively, not one person trying to do everything and get someone to open up. So things that can help in a collaboration is just letting them know, for example, if they're emotionally unavailable, hey, I'm just feeling a bit disconnected from you. Just, you know, wondering about the future of our relationship. So kind of making it talk about how you feel and then reflect on how it impacts the bigger picture can be really helpful, because if you just say something like, hey, I'm feeling really cut off from you, that can equal defensiveness. So as Ames always says, use those I statements, not the you statements, and how you feel. Another thing that can be really helpful if the other person is wanting to, like if they can acknowledge that they are maybe shutting down or not being as emotionally available, you can definitely do love languages together. That's a really fun test to do together. Perhaps they're not emotionally unavailable. Perhaps you're just not picking up on their love language. Also, I guess just a practical thing I was thinking of, Ames, we say this, is just when you do have that conversation with them, trying to be non-confrontational as possible. So, you know, talking to them while they're in the car, you're not staring at each other deep in the soul. While you're on a walk together, just saying, I think those things can be really make the other person feel safe. I think that's what you want to do, is make them feel safe and, you know, not put any blame on them, because we don't know why someone's emotionally unavailable. Sometimes it can be from a whole host of reasons, maybe a previous heartbreak that's resulted in pain, and or maybe previous trauma. I mean, you know, so you really can't push that. So just being really gentle with it. But I think also if they're not willing to engage, and it's really affecting your relationship, I think it's worthwhile looking into either couples counseling, or perhaps even just, you know, maybe nudging them into the direction of looking into their own mental health. So that can just be, you know, hey, I found this really cool podcast, or I, you know, heard this really
shameless plug.
Well, no, I was thinking, I'm just generalizing that it's a male partner. There are some quite good male podcasts specifically for mental health out there, which could be obviously a lot, maybe a little bit more
relatable.
Yeah, that's the word I was saying. God, I can hear that pina colada stat. Yeah, so I think just pointing them in some direction, but not expecting that they will take all of your directives. Sometimes they just need to be empowered to do it themselves. So I think looking at the bigger picture and just kind of saying to them, as I said before, you know, I'm worried that our relationship is is impacted, or we're not going the way that I thought we would. I really want to talk to you and connect with you more. You know, what are some options that we have? So make it a we thing, not a you or a me thing. A we thing. I think that's really important as well.
Absolutely. I love those points. I think that's really important. I think also in previous episodes, we've discussed that it's really common for these relationship dynamics to take place. And I think what is needed is a balance between separateness and togetherness that works for both you and your partner. I've spoken about this in terms of the ambivalent and avoidant relationship dynamic, but what this reminds me of is the pursuer and the distancer pattern. The distancer will often retreat under stress, and this might intensify the partner's need for closeness, thus the desire to pursue or keep pursuing, you know, give me that emotional closeness. Your needs, communication, discussion, togetherness, and expression. They are urgent in their efforts to fix what they think is wrong, and they want to fix it really, really quickly. They're anxious about what the distance their partner has created, and they take that really personally. So the problem is that if this pattern becomes really, really entrenched, neither person is getting their needs met. And ultimately, that is what relationship success comes down to, is how well can we meet our partner's needs, or how well are our needs being met in our relationship? So the changes need to be driven by the desire to do better and have a healthier relationship, not to get instant reciprocation. So pursuers are known for being quite outcome dependent and have a hard time making changes without expectations, and distancers are known for being stubborn and have difficulty with the first move when under pressure. So the recommendation that I would give, on top of all Kat's fabulous suggestions that I would also definitely agree with, is we are relational beings. So we, from the minute we come out of the womb, our whole being is in response to the other. So when one partner makes a commitment to change their approach and their response on a consistent basis, the relationship will transform, because how you listen to them will change how they respond to you, and how you respond to them will change how they react to you. So absolutely, it is a we thing. But if you have someone that you are perceiving as quite emotionally unavailable, I think understanding your relationship dynamic and that your patterns of relating, so maybe looking into your attachment style, either doing some research or with a therapist, and then, like I said, make a commitment to changing on your end and your approach and your responses, and your relationship will transform.
Absolutely love that. Really, really love that. Ames, next question. And this is one that's very relevant for the moment and has been for the last 6 months. Tips on how to concentrate when working from home.
Oh, okay. Love this. I'm not speaking from experience because I haven't really worked from home for probably longer than a collective of 2 weeks. But what I have heard to be really effective is routine and structure is crucial, but with some variation. Having different exercises and tasks at different times is really important, especially with the time you might be saving on commuting and traveling to work. I would say dress to impress, even if you aren't seeing anyone. There have been a lot of social psychology studies that have used the term enclothed cognition to describe the way clothes can affect your behavior. So don't skip the shower either. You know, there's evidence to suggest that a cold shower can really boost your mood and attention and alleviate any of those morning worries when our cortisol is at its highest. Plus, you won't smell. Not that I'm saying you smell, but if you have a shower, you're really,
really clean, really clean for that Zoom
meeting.
You're
clean, you're fresh, you're smelling good, you're feeling fine. Boundaries are really important. Mm. So physically separate your workspace from your living space. I think also consider your work environment. You know, are you sitting next to a window? What's the temperature in your room like? What's the noise like? Airflow. All really important for concentration. If we are stuck in a dingy, you know, poorly lit, no natural lighting, stuffy room, of course we're going to get distracted. Of course we're not going to be motivated to do our work. We're not going to be functioning optimally. So creating a really nice work environment is so important. And my last little tip would be exercise. Mm. So whether you take frequent breaks throughout the day to break up your exercise, you know, you might do a little workout in the morning, you might go for a walk on your lunch break, you might do some stretching. It gives us those endorphins, those feel good neurochemicals, and it's just great for productivity and concentration. So over to you, Kat, what would your top
Absolutely.
Tips be?
I think something that helped me, I work from home quite a lot, is if you are in a room that is also your bedroom, for example, you live in an apartment shared with someone else, or you live with your family, or you just live in an environment where your desk is where your bed is, getting up and trying to find a library, going out to a park, I know there's like shared workspaces you can rent, because that really increases the separation between your home and your work. And that is so, so crucial. Another thing that does help if you are, your brain will associate your laptop sitting on your desk with work, and it's a lot harder to switch off. So something that I have found to be really helpful for myself is once my computer's off, I will pack it away and go put it in my car, or I will just put it under a bed so I'm not having those automatic thoughts. Like when I see my laptop, I will immediately think, oh, I've got to do that, or I forgot to do that, I've got to write that email or whatever. Having that space between your laptop, even just putting it away, or anything that reminds you of work, your notepad, phone, please put that away. That can be really, really helpful to just help you switch off when it's out of work hours. Yes, exercise, super helpful, really good diet, making sure you're eating healthy foods. This is probably on our next question, but actually music can really help you to concentrate. It's a difficult thing, and I do just want to normalize it's so easy to lose concentration when you're working from home. If there's no one to keep you accountable, if there's no one looking over your shoulder, it's so easy to duck on to the Iconic or to online shop. I know I totally do. And, you know, we kind of lose a bit of that motivation or accountability. So I think just setting a timer as well, if you're someone that's consistently losing motivation, just saying, okay, I'm going to do like 5 minutes of work and then I'm going to let myself have 1 minute of online shopping or social media time. And there's apps you can get as well that will switch off your phone and make you work, which is pretty hardcore. But if that's what you're into, then definitely give that a crack. I don't know if I could do that. But yeah, I think just looking up some tips and tricks, but also knowing that it's so normal, particularly this time of year, particularly given this year, it's okay to lose some motivation and concentration when you're working from home. So just having a little bit of self-compassion as well.
Absolutely. And Kat, as you mentioned, our next question is, and our last question for this evening, we always say that we're going to whiz through these and be really quick, and it ends up being a 3-hour long potty. So without further ado, our last question is thoughts on music and how it can positively influence your mental health. Take it away.
I will just say, before I dive into this one, you know that when we put the question box up on Instagram, we're getting a lot more responses in, and I'm just nervous. I hate letting people down. I hate like disappointing people. We've gotten like 4 or 5 more questions since we started, but look, it's fine. Music, how it positively influences your mental health. Really good question. Sorry, that was such a tangent. Yes, I actually did my thesis on this exact topic, and it is a very, very interesting topic on music and its effect on your cognition and your mental health. So actually, music psychology is a field of research, and I think that if you are interested in both music and psychology, this could be a really cool thing to study. So music has a really positive impact on mental health as well as performance. So it really can improve your performance in the cognitive domains of attention, retention, and working memory. There's also a lot of positive implications for music impacting on dementia and Alzheimer's. So in terms of mental health side of things, our brains trigger particular emotions, memories, and thoughts when we listen to music, which often leads to more positive effects on our mental health. So when we listen to music, something that can happen is stress reduction. So for example, when you are listening to your meditation music, when you're listening to your chill playlist on Spotify, that has such a big impact on your mood. Do you also notice that when you listen to those really, like those really hardcore, like screamo songs or like the upbeat R&B, it has a big impact on your mood. It can actually increase your heart rate and therefore lead to that more hyper arousal. Also, one thing I noticed, Ames, do you notice that when you listen to like those dirty R&B beats or a bit of the screamo, like just the loud rock music, I drive faster. It's almost like I'm in like, I take more risks when I listen to those things, and like, it's good for motivation, especially at the gym, but just be really mindful that your music taste has such a big impact on your mood and therefore in your stress levels. So it's good to have a little bit of that stress for the gym or for exercise, but too much stress can obviously have negative impacts. On the other hand, listening to that really slow, relaxing music can lead to a reduction in stress. So that's one thing that can really help to know when you are choosing your next music track.
Absolutely. And if you are interested in music therapy, there is such a thing. So there is an Australian Music Therapy Association. If you are wanting to get more information, just Google Australian Music Therapy Association, and they explain how music therapy improves mental health and well-being by, exactly like Kat was saying, reducing stress and anxiety, regulating our mood, increasing motivation, managing anger. In fact, I don't know if you were a drum facilitator when you worked in schools, Kat, but some things that we do, especially with little boys, is use drums for social skills groups when little boys have issues with emotional regulation. Oh my goodness, maybe I need to listen to some music because it can improve verbal and nonverbal communication. But yes, rhythm is great because it hits that point in your brain that is responsible for managing anger and frustration, and it can help manage challenging behavior. And yes, also studies have shown that improves verbal and nonverbal communication. So I might have to sit down and listen to some music after this podcast. So I can
you please do some drumming for the podcast? Can we listen to?
Absolutely.
Oh, I would love that. A hot tip, guys, something that I studied when I was in honors, is that if you listen to instrumental music with a 4x4 beat, it can actually have really positive implications for short-term memory. So if you are studying for an exam, then a 4x4 instrumental song will really help. So heard it here first.
Amazing. And that was published, by the way. Kat's thesis was published. So Yeah.
Thanks, girl.
She's kind of a big deal.
I think everyone's was published. I don't think it was anything special. one more thing classic before we wrap up is sleep. Music can have a really, really big impact on your sleep. Obviously, that's why when you listen to any, sleep meditations or sleep playlists on Spotify, they're all quite relaxing. No one's going to put in Metallica there or anything that's pretty hardcore. So your relaxing music can calm your nervous system down, which in therefore relaxes you and then therefore will be able to put you into a good sleep. So really, and we know that sleep has such a good impact on our mental health. The amount of sleep that we get will impact on our mental health. So that's another thing. So yes, music is wonderful. Ames, I think we should do an episode on this. I really love the impact of music on mental health and cognition. So maybe we'll do a little ep about this.
Absolutely. Maybe you should do one or do a little IGTV, considering it is your little thing, well, not little, considering it is your thesis topic and you studied tirelessly on it.
Tirelessly. Yeah. Anyone that has done their thesis will understand.
She probably couldn't forget about it if she wanted to.
I'm still triggered every time I hear the word thesis and statistical analysis. Okay, there's one more aim if you feel like answering it, but it might be a good one to wrap the show up. Tips on finding the right psychologist or mental health professional.
That's a really great question. Kat, would you like to start?
So obviously it's really good to know not just to take what you've been given. And I think like any health professional, you might feel like, oh, I just got to take the one that my doctor refers me to or that my mum goes to or that my friend goes to. But that's not the case. I think it's you really need to find the right fit because you will be talking to them about some things that are quite vulnerable or are quite painful and you need to feel comfortable with that person. If you don't feel comfortable, then you're not, therapy will be ineffective. So rapport is the most important positive predictor of therapy success. So you might have a preference for older females and that's okay, or older men. You might have a preference for younger therapists, people who can relate to you more. So I think it's okay to have preferences. It's okay to go through a few different ones and find the one that suits you. Don't feel guilty if they just didn't sit right with you. I think on the same token as though, because we're in the field, if you're with a psychologist and you've been through a few and you just can't seem to find the right fit, it's okay to tell psychologist or the counselor that they're doing something that isn't sitting well with you, or that you want to talk about more of a specific thing that they're not touching on. You can tell them that they're wrong. Those things are really helpful for therapists. Trust me, we know from the other side of things. So don't go through and expect that everyone can read your mind. So that's just really important to know as well. You can also speak up and say, hey, actually, I don't really like that that style. Do you have any other styles we can work under? Or, oh, I don't really want to talk about that. I prefer to focus on X, Y, and Z. So, you can speak up as well. So I think that's, therapy is about the client and the therapist collaborating together. So I think both of those things is important to think about.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't have too much more to add to that because I think they are all really great, important points. I think one of the most important things to evaluate whether you feel that you have a good fit with your therapist, which is probably the most important thing, is your connection to them and how safe and comfortable you feel. Is do you feel heard? Do you feel like you are comfortable to go to really personal topics and to share really personal stories with them? So how you feel in session with them, it would be a really good indication of how good your fit is. I think also do your research on theoretical orientation. It sounds really, really tricky, but because psychology is so broad and diverse and there are so many different modalities and frameworks, I think really get to know what you are looking at working on in therapy and what theoretical orientation aligns to your therapeutic goals. I think that's also really, really important. And if the psychological service that you're going to does offer like a meet and greet option or, a complimentary session or phone call or something to get to know them first, take advantage of that, use that, because then maybe you won't feel that, not that you should, but that obligation to continue. You know, it's good to just get a sense of what that fit might look like. Because seeing a psychologist, if it is your first time, or even seeing a different therapist for the first time, can be a really daunting prospect. So I think maybe having that opportunity to just have a little meet, see if the fit is right, see if you feel comfortable, and the dynamic works for you, that's something that can be super helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of psychologists now do have their own Instagram page. So you can also look up psychologists on Instagram.
Great idea.
Yeah, I think that's really clever because it gives you a bit of a taste of what they're like. I know that's something that we've had some really good feedback about AIMS, is that because people listen to our podcast, they know what kind of therapist that we are. And I think for other psychologists and counselors as well, that's a really good idea. So people can get a taste before booking for a session. So yes, have a little look at those. AIMS, I think that is all the time we have for this episode. It has been an absolute year, an absolute pleasure working with you, my dear. And we'll be back next year for some exciting, maybe some exciting new things we have got in the works on the board.
It's on the board, guys. Exciting things to happen in 2021.
We can't wait for next year. It's going to be a great year. This year has been a huge year, and I have a sneaky suspicion 2021 will be even bigger. Which fills me with
bigger
excitement
and better
and low-key anxiety, but here we are.
Absolutely. Yeah. Again, we can't thank you enough for your continuous support over the year that has been 2020. A fucked year, if you will. And we just hope that you all get a break and have some rest over the festive season. I know the festive season can be tough times for some, and Kat and I definitely acknowledge that sometimes this time of year is not easy. So if you are weathering the perfect storm that has been the fucked year of 2020 and you are going into another storm that is the silly season, our thoughts are with you. And we just wish everyone a really easy festive season after a really tough year.
Yeah, absolutely. Reach out for help if you need it. Lifeline is available, Mental Health Line. I'll leave all those links in the notes for you guys so you have some support over the break if you do need it. But we love you guys. Thank you so much for this year. You guys have been so supportive and understanding when we sometimes miss an episode. And we absolutely adore our listeners. You guys are absolutely the best, especially our Bulgarian listeners. All right, guys, we'll catch you next year. Have a wonderful and merry Christmas and festive season. And we'll catch you on the flip side.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks so much for tuning in to today's episode. If you're not already, please follow us on Instagram at The Psychology Sisters. We are also now providing online psychological sessions. For more information, please follow us at The Psych Collaborative. See you next time.